Hello, and thank you for joining us for another installment of More Trivium. Today we're going to be introducing you to logic. We're going to be talking about the logic stage. If you haven't already heard the introduction to More Trivium with Gino Denning, or Trivium and Intellectual Pilgrimage, or Grammar, then you're going to want to listen to those, because it just makes more sense if you have the basis first before you listen to this. Now, you can listen to the logic stage and then go back and listen to the other ones. Of course, you'll benefit from it anyway, but you will get more benefit if you listen to them in order. So definitely check out An Intellectual Pilgrimage, and then More Trivium with Gino Denning, and then the review of the Grammar stage. These are all very good. I hope that you're getting as much out of them as I am doing them. It's been a phenomenal experience. And before I talk too much about the philosophy, we're going to talk about that more as the sessions go on, and you're going to find out everything you need to know. Today is part one of what will be two parts of the logic stage, also known as the understanding stage in the trivium concept, the conceptual principle of learning via trivium. So we're going to go ahead and take a look at logic and understanding and kind of wrap our minds around what exactly is we're dealing with here. I hope that you enjoy it. And if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, of course, you can always communicate with us at unpluggedmom.com. Go ahead and enjoy logic. Welcome, Gene. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you once again for having me. And each time we get together for one of these little conversations, I become more and more excited about the way it's going. I think we're making some real inroads into introducing this to the home educating crowd, and hopefully anyone who's interested in learning how to learn and learning how to think for themselves.
You know, Gene, I'm glad that you brought that up, because I too find myself excited about each session that we're doing, and I'm growing more and more excited about the whole idea. I have learned so much from the sessions that we're doing and the reading that I'm doing independently, and I feel more and more how important this is for society and for anyone that is really interested in pursuing a greater understanding of basically their existence and the world around us. And I can see more and more evidence of how society has shifted away from this. So I'm very grateful to you, and I continue to be very excited about learning more with my audience. So thanks again for that.
Why, certainly.
All right. What I'd like to begin with before we move into logic, which is what we're going to be focusing on in this session, let's do a little recap of grammar so we can kind of segue into that for those who are listening a little bit more smoothly. So can you give us a recap of the grammar stage?
Yes. And before I do, let me just recapitulate for the adults, the parents in the audience, as to just what it is that is affected and why we are pursuing this line of inquiry. And I think it's because we need to have a historical perspective for most people to understand where we came from. So the things that have appeared to connect with adults, with life experience, and life experience I'm often using as a synonym for prejudice, because by the time we go through our childhood and adolescent years, and we reach that age 21, when we become active in life, when we enter the active stage of family and career life, we do have some ideas that are difficult to get past. And these are judgments that were made in the past or that were given to us, and they show up as prejudice. But often, if you take a historical perspective as to why we have come to this point, how it is that we came to this point, it gets through those prejudicial viewpoints or some of the life experience recollection that we have. So starting very basically and very historically, we went into the types of consciousness, that the that the plant kingdom, for example, has a type of preconsciousness, really, which is just stimulus response. Is in the objective natural world, there are stimuli out there, and those entities which are alive, which reproduce, have a respiration and take in nourishment or energy, have a finite existence as that entity, have this stimulus response. For example, the sun going from the eastern horizon to the western during the day, a plant will have its leaves or its flowering parts follow it. And that is stimulus response. There is no memory involved. The next day it just happens again, and the memory, if anything, is within the DNA or RNA to have that response. And the next level is the perceptual level. And this is where memory is introduced, where we actually remember the stimulus and the response. And after a while, we know that a particular stimulus comes up and we have a response. And this is really the basic level in which we live, because we, as mammals and as humans, have learned in the past from our surroundings and the living entities amongst us how to respond. So it becomes automatized. It goes into the middle portion, the limbic portion of our brain, when we institute this idea of memory, of having a sense of the past, of things happening before. And usually the perceptual level gives us ideas of things, of entities out there. Our five senses take in particular sights, sounds, feelings, odors, and tastes, and we do recall, so we can, when we encounter it in the present day, we can recall if it's occurred before. If it hasn't, it gets our attention. And this is what the mind, the brain, pays attention to, is something new. So at this stage, in the idea that we understand the difference in things in our environment, we can have this elementary idea of learning. We can learn from trial and error because we do have a memory of it. And then we come up to the human form of cognition, of the way our mind works, which is the conceptual level. And this, of course, includes all the two former modes, but also now includes not only the knowledge of things, but that we have this thing called a mind. Is the conceptual level leads to a consciousness of our very own consciousness. So we are self-conscious. We not only see things, but we have this idea of modeling or making predictions based on things we have learned in the past. And again,
we have the sense of self.
We have the sense of self, yeah. We're the only ones that show evidence of a sense of self-consciousness. Consciousness of our own consciousness. And what that is, as I say, this ability to model things that have not necessarily happened in the objective world. These are models in our own mind. And so we can model new experiences before they occur based on experiences we already have had in the past. So this is really prediction. This is what the conceptual level is, that we're putting together a mental environment in which we want to accomplish a particular outcome. And we can do this in the conceptual level by bringing in these observations, integrating them all into our own worldview, which again is an abstraction. We are very adept at abstraction, building these models and making predictions from there. And the stimulus which gets our attention more than anything else are new stimuli, something new in the environment, or something that doesn't belong. During our childhood and adolescence, we gather together our experience. We're taught by our parents, our tribe, our clan, and by the various aspects of nature, our own observation. And then that's pretty well set at the end of our adolescent period. We go into our active period of life at 21, 22 in our modern civilizations and cultures, excuse me. That is today's world, essentially. But we have this model of our world, and this is the model that we continue to work on throughout life. And this is where the idea of learning, of lifetime learning, comes in. So we can continue to expand not only the model, but our experience in life and our accomplishment in life.
So,
accomplishment amongst one another.
Is it safe to summarize that as in saying the model of our world is established during our early childhood and our youth, and that provides the foundation for how we live in our adult life?
Yes. And as I say, if we're fortunate enough not to have some of these concepts schooled out of us, we can continue to build on that model rather than being stunted in the childhood or adolescent model without being able to move out of it. We're essentially put into a binary situation in order to stun us, and that's to have a choice between A or B. And so we get into this idea, and this is part of the prejudicial viewpoint, is that we must make a choice between one or the other. You're either a male or a female. You know, you either think as a male or you think as a female. You're either a Republican or a Democrat. You're a Christian or a Muslim. Each one of these separates us, keeps us separate from others so that we cannot cooperate. We're in competition, essentially, with one another. But it's this spirit of cooperation which really moves us forward. And, of course, the ultimate choice, the ultimate binary choice, is you're either with me or you're against me. This is what separates all of us from this idea of cooperation, of moving humankind forward, not just you moving a specific segment of us forward. Because we all, as I'd mentioned in one of our previous talks, we all have the potential. Each one of us has the potential to realize this.
Right. Well, we're basically blank slates when we're children, and we're ready to discover and learn about our world. So when we enter into this system, this artificial system, at young ages, such as 3, 4, 5 years old, and this binary system right from that age is pretty much conditioning us right from the start to accept a paradigm in life, and we grow up seeing our world in this paradigm, and we have to choose between left and right, like you say, and that kind of establishes the paradigm in society, the left-right paradigm in society. And yeah, it does cause a lot of problems. But let's before we digress too much into that, because I could have a political conversation. I can have a political conversation, and my listeners know that for hours. So before we digress too much, let's continue with the summarizing of the grammar stage. I just have a couple questions about the grammar stage, and then we'll go ahead and go into logic. So you talked about the stimulus and memory and recall, and then conceptual level. And, you know, then we talked about the early childhood, and how this relates to knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. I just have a couple of questions about the grammar stage.
Before we go there, let's just go to one other item of history, and that's really the groups of ways to explain. There are three different ways we have developed in order to see our world with our conceptual faculty. And the first method of seeing the universe, or cosmology, we might say, and our mind, or psychology, we may say, So I'm trying to introduce these terms that are synonymous, because often individuals will relate to one term more personally than they do to another. And I had mentioned that in fact, what exists is existence itself, and then consciousness of that existence. So in human perspective, there is existence and consciousness. Another way to look at this is there is cosmology, the universe, and psychology, our mind, which is aware of that universe and the way it relates to it. So the first things, the first method of explaining ourselves and our universe was to compare things, the analogical method. And we started out by making comparisons of unknown phenomena or unknown, newly discovered things to things we already knew. And this is making the comparison. And the most effective way of communicating this to other people is to make people stories out of them. And this is essentially mythology, where we related cosmology to psychology, because we knew something of our own mind, and we would project an anthropomorphic, a human form, to these various aspects of our observations, either things or attributes, actions, and so forth. And these were the gods of old that soon morphed into the one god of nature, the nature of existence. But we were still making comparisons, and of course we still are today. Mythology has become religion, as we mentioned previously, and then a religion continues to grow, and then the previous religion now becomes the new religionist's mythology, and so on and so forth. So now we're in comparisons. The next stage up is philosophy. And this was developed because of the idea of mythology. But rather than using a comparison, we looked at the thing in itself. And philosophy is really a system by which we look at the phenomenon, or we look at the thing, and not introduce an anthropomorphic entity and its motivations into the mix. And of course, I use the analogy of an earthquake, that in mythological times, the cause of an earthquake was due to the anger of a supernatural god, like Neptune in the classical pantheon. And then a school of thought arose, which was looking at the thing in itself. In the Western tradition, it was Thales of Miletus, who was considered the father of Western philosophy. And his school looked at the idea of the ground, the earth, or the island being agitated by the agitation of the sea, which was agitated by the cosmic ocean. The blue sky that surrounds us was another fluid ocean that agitated the earthly watery ocean, and that in turn shook the landmass. And that was erroneous, of course, but he was trying to do away with analogy. He was trying to look at the nature of the thing itself. And this is the idea of philosophy, which is essentially four branches of looking at what is. I'm not going to go into the technical terms, but the first branch is just the greatest question of all: what is? What is around us? The second question is, how do we know? What do we use to come to these conclusions for looking to see what is? And here you see the progression from cosmology, or everything that is, to psychology, which is how do we use our mind to relate to everything that is. And then because we were going into a new way of living in ancient Greece, going from tribes and clans into cities, or as they called it, polities, they were looking for ways to optimize our own existence. How do we act according to what we know of what is? How we know what is? How do we act to our own advantage and the advantage of those around us in our environment? Personally, we call that personal ethics. How do we act as individuals to optimize our stay on Earth? And as a group, as a polity, as we're going into these cities, city-states, how do we act as a group? And of course, they call that section of ethics politics, but today we have a connotation of politics that is anything but ethical. So I just call it civil ethics. So ethics in general is just individual and group optimum behavior. This is the model that we have come up with, and the way we act on that model. We predict our action, our optimal action within those models, which continue to grow. I mean, that's what human progression is the growth of these models. And then finally, the growth of the actuality of those models, the potentiality that's built into those models. And then finally, how do we communicate all this? How do we communicate what we know, how we know, the optimal action, thought, and action? And we did this with the seven fine arts at that time, which is fine painting, sculpture, architecture, drama, music, dance, and poetry or literature. So those are the seven fine arts, the artificial things that we have come up with to communicate these various things. And then finally, from the mythological and the philosophic, we came up with the scientific method. And I have to distinguish the scientific method because this is the most focused of all. And the scientific method requires demonstration. And it was the Greek philosopher Aristotle who came up with essentially the rules of science, which was to demonstrate. Anything that was demonstrated could be said to be of a relationship to all that came before it and fits into what is today. In other words, there are no contradictions. Nature has no contradictions. So if you're looking for natural law, you want to demonstrate it through experimentation. And there are essentially, some people call it a three-step method, the scientific method. Others call it, I, for example, call it a four-step method. But it is a way to actually demonstrate natural law and then to come up with a statement for it. And it should be with that statement, you can now repeat the experiment or the natural law or develop a technology with it. So those are the three stages of the modes in which we have developed as a species. So then we come forward after making an attempt to have parents or adults come to realize why do we need this idea of the way we continue in our species to operate? How do we properly operate? And I'm saying coming forward because so many of our kind in this thing we call civilization have essentially abdicated the natural way in which they think, the natural way of putting a body of knowledge, of coherent knowledge together, grammar, the natural way of understanding that body if it is not coherent. And this is really what logic is. It's understanding. It's bringing understanding. But how do you bring understanding to a body of knowledge? If one thing follows from another grammatically or sequentially, the thing that stands out in there, which doesn't seem to fit, is what the process of logic actually removes. It removes contradictions. And it is a method, which we'll be covering today, or at least the branches of this method of taking out contradictions, That's really what logic is. It's bringing understanding to the body of knowledge. So they're intimately connected, but a separate, essentially, discipline, as we have brought a methodology to each one of these. These are natural processes, but in order to communicate it, we have come up with methods of devising rules. And then the third stage is rhetoric, or the actual communication, and of course the refinement. Rhetoric is bringing these ideas of what we know, how we have come to understand it. In other words, the argument, the process of coming to the understanding, why it is so, and communicating to others amongst us, or bringing our own personal dialogue either to writing or to reviewing it in our personal dialectic. But rhetoric is actually the use of knowledge and understanding in the real world. And in not too distant times, this was called wisdom. The use of knowledge and understanding in the real objective world. And so we can use those terms instead of using grammar, logic, and rhetoric. We can use the terms of knowledge, understanding, and wisdom as another way of relating these ideas. Now, these are all rules-based, and grammar has been developed as the segment which has the most concise and the most numerous of rules. But there are basic rules in there which we pretty much covered in our session on grammar, which are the parts of speech, the parts of speech which relate to the real world. And then there are numerous rules in grammar and in linguistics that one can get more involved in. But once you have the basics, you can move on to the next stage, which is bringing understanding. And understanding requires an internal dialogue in order to bring that quality to it of taking the contradictions out. But taking a contradiction out of a body of knowledge is not an end in itself. It's really the body of knowledge as a coherent entity that we're looking for. What we have assembled grammatically is what makes the knowledge come alive in our lives. It's the understanding that's brought to that knowledge. And then finally, we've gotten to the point where we can relate this to others or to really review it within our own mind and see if it works in the real world, wisdom. So you can see how this has led to all three of our modes of thinking, making comparisons, mythology, in the grammatical stage, understanding the thing itself, the philosophy of it in the logic stage, and finally the demonstration in rhetoric, bringing the knowledge and understanding forth to others and to yourself, and this is demonstrated or scientific. So all of these are related, although the trivium, as we have become accustomed to calling it now, the trivium is what is the most ancient of the understanding that we have come to. The trivium, the three steps of the trivium, or that pattern of thinking, predate mythology, philosophy, and science, or the scientific method. So, by taking our knowledge of grammar, or concentrating on that one definition of existence, existence is every substance, action, and state of being, attribute, and relationship that is, was, or ever will be. There is the total of our comprehension of what is in that statement right there. So grammar again can be restated. We can restate that just as a review, as that existence is every noun, verb, adjective, and adverb, and prepositional phrase within the three dimensions of time. So this is how basic grammar is. It relates us to time, action, and space.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Gene. And now, as we move into logic, before we do that, just to kind of bring the audience together, and I just want to summarize something to serve as a reminder and to kind of reestablish why we're doing this and where we stand when we're doing this. Now, you talked about the basic questions, okay, that date back, and I feel that these are the most accurate representations of how we live our lives in the most basic natural sense, okay? And that is, we ask what is, and then we ask how do we know what is, and then the third question is, what do we do with it? What do we do with that understanding of that knowledge? Okay, so first we discover the knowledge, and then we try to understand it, and then what do we do with it? Okay, and these are the stages of knowledge, understanding, and then wisdom. Or, of course, in the end, we have ethics, which is how do we act, what do we do with it, and of course, communicating that back into the world. Now, if we take a look.
Excuse me for interrupting, but there is a way of looking at wisdom and rhetoric as being either synonymous or very closely related. You did a very good job of connecting the branches of the later developed philosophy to the way our mind works. And it only makes sense that we would develop something along those lines, a mirror of the way our mind works, which is grammar, logic, and rhetoric. But I'm glad that you're continuing to remind us as, or at least bringing up the question as to why are we doing this? Because these subjects can get so abstract that people lose the thread of what am I doing here? We're looking at a model. But we're looking at the segments of the model without having the whole piece. And you keep coming back to that question, why are we doing this? Because it is very easy, mostly for adults, not again, not for children because they don't have the experience, but it is very easy for adults to get lost in the trees and not know their way out of the forest. So, excuse me for interrupting, but I thought that was a good analogy that you made there between the branches of the trivium and philosophy. So
Well,
continue.
yeah, what I'm trying to do is communicate, if you will, how I'm understanding the knowledge that I've been acquiring, if that makes sense. And that's what I'm trying to do right now is kind of figure out for myself, okay, now that I know this and I understand it, what am I doing with it? And I think I've established what I'm doing with it. And now here I am on the microphone with you trying to communicate it back into the world. So it's all part of my own process of learning. But the point that I want to make right here to the audience right now, and I think is important, is that first of all, there's two points here. First of all, when we ask these questions, what is, how do we know what is, and then what do we do with it, and how do we communicate it? And those last two are complement each other,
Yes.
okay? This is, if we look at it in a very specific sense, this is basically how we learn anything, even if we're learning how to cook a new meal. Okay, if we focus it on one particular thing, which I don't want to compartmentalize subjects because that's not the idea. We're trying to look at life as a whole. But if we try to relate this to learning anything new, anything that we're interested in learning new, the first thing we do is discover it. The next thing we do is try to understand it. And the next thing, natural step after that, after we discover it, the next natural step is understanding it. And the next natural step after that is, okay, now what do I do with this information and how do I communicate this information? So this is the natural process of learning. This is the natural and organic way in which your human brain works. But we could take that outside of something specific and into a broader sense. This is the way that we live our lives. So we can use this idea, we can relate this idea to an hour of learning something, or we can relate it to several months of learning a particular area of interest, or we can relate it to a very broad sense, which is how we live our lives. In the first stage of our lives, when we're children, we're in the mode of discovery. We're discovering, we're gathering data. And this is the grammar stage. This is building relationships, as you talked about in the grammar stage. This is non-understanding. This is discovering and observing. And then we move into the next stage of learning, okay? And as it relates to our lives and the cycle of our lives, that is the logic stage, which is what we're going to talk about today, and that is understanding. So we discover and we know, and then we spend time understanding what we know. How do we know it? And then the next stage, which we're going to go over in a different session, is now what do we do with it and how do we communicate it? And that's the rhetoric. So we focused on stage one, the grammar stage, in the previous section, and now we're going to focus on the logic stage. I just wanted to reiterate that so that we understand. Now, I also want to reiterate the second point that I want to make before we go ahead and go into the session on logic is I know that there are many parents out there that still feel a little bit of resistance because they feel like, well, this is a method, this is a process. I want to communicate again to you, and this is so important, that the reason it feels this way to you is because we have essentially been trained out of it. We've been reprogrammed, if you will, to accept an artificial process of learning as a society, and this has been happening over decades and decades and decades, and generation to generation to generation. So for you now, even though you've pulled your child out of school and you're embracing home education because you know something's wrong with the education system, you have to take that a step further in your mind and realize that you are a product of this society. And you have been reprogrammed into this artificial method. So this return to the organic might feel a little bit strange to you at first. And the analogy I use is that when you're so used to riding along on the conveyor belt, when you first step off and try to walk on your own feet, it feels weird. But then after a while, you realize that walking on your own feet is so much more natural than riding along on the conveyor belt. And that's why we need to name this something. Okay, that's why we need to call it a method, because the method serves as a guide back to the organic nature of learning. We wouldn't need it if we were never reprogrammed out of it, but since we were, now we do, and here we go, and we're on the journey. Now, that said, we reviewed grammar and we went through it pretty thoroughly in the first session, and we are going to do more sessions on this. So there's going to be practical application later on after we've gone over everything. We're going to ask some practical application questions and go over that. But we reviewed an understanding of grammar. Now we're going to review in this session an understanding of logic, or as much as we can in the time that we have. So let's go ahead and go into that. And the first question I have on that, Jean, of course. Now, we already went over what is the logic stage, and the logic stage is taking the knowledge that we have and understanding it. But let's go a little bit further into that. What is this stage about? What is the goal of this stage in reference to the Trivium method of learning? And more specifically, once we go over that, why do we introduce this stage or start flowing into this stage around the age of 11 years old, which is the adolescence. What is significant about that age in childhood?
The mammal, of course, has an extended childhood, usually with the mother. We've developed a family situation where the father has input, along with siblings and the extended family. And this is what mammals do in childhood. They take in data. They don't have a deep cognizance of what that data is. They're just good at bringing in, and of course, this is a physiological situation with the brain. They're good at absorbing and memorizing and taking in language-based ideas. But they don't have a deep understanding, nor do they have a need. They don't. They're still dependent on their family. They don't have a need to operate independently yet. And this is just the way nature has designed mammals. And the more advanced the mammal, generally the longer the period of childhood. So if you're a perceptual animal, all you need is to have the data. You just have to have a vague sense of what things are. If you're a wolf, for example, you're a predatory type animal. Your family, so to speak, teaches you how to hunt. But there are also things out there that are dangerous to you, like venomous snakes. So you learn this as you go along, that there are things that you go toward and there are things that are dangerous to you and you stay away from. But you don't understand what venom is. You don't understand what protein is, which is what fuels you. As we developed as mammals, we started to lose all these other things that could be used in nature and started to depend on our minds more and methods of modifying our environment. We became more understanding of what a venomous or a dangerous animal or situation was. And I like the analogy that you used of being on a conveyor belt, because in a larger sense, if you go back to our origins, we were coming upon new environments. If we were the type if we lived in the type of society that moved, for example, and we would come into a new environment, and there were new benefits and new dangers there, and we had to learn what those were. We had to take in the data, and then we had to say, well, here is a snake, for example, that looks like this other one that's venomous, but this one isn't venomous. And so it's not dangerous to us. So there are practical applications to coming to understanding. And what we're doing is, again, making an analogy to where we came from to this new situation, which really grabs our attention. Whenever you get into a new environment, you step on an airplane and you go to an exotic place, what to you is exotic, everything is new to you. And it really grabs your attention, and that's one of the reasons you want to go there, is to experience this new sensation of having your attention grasped by the environment, by the newness of it all, until you come to understand, take all the things that have grabbed your attention, taken the contradictions out of it, and why is it in this environment? What makes this environment of a whole, of a piece? Well, that environment, once you come to understand it, is the body of knowledge of that place. So it's not just undifferentiated knowledge. We have a number of these models in our head, and we call them subjects of study. So we either develop subjects of study, which has been the basic case up to the more modern era, that we were developing these bodies of study. Now we've become pretty much globalized, and there aren't that many new environments for us to explore in the physical dimension, in the physical world, in the on our planet. And so now we're starting to go back to studying ourselves, or hopefully we're going to go back to studying ourselves. And you are very correct in saying that this has been taken away from us. I was in touch with a professor at the University of Texas, and we got into a conversation. And I was saying that the childhood or adolescent stage has more or less been inculcated in the adult population of this country in particular, is what we were speaking of. And he says, well, we don't want to interrupt that. that harmony. He says, because if you leave people to their own devices, just look around. And I said, well, that's my point. If we did leave them to their own devices, they wouldn't be childish. They wouldn't be adolescent in
right.
their
Well,
behavior.
The fact of the
they
matter
would be
is,
adult.
Right, exactly. The fact of the matter is, and I think this is a problem with a lot of this kind of clinging to new age trends and everything else is when we say we want to leave people alone, leave them to their own devices. It's an illusion. We've been tricked into believing that we're thinking in an enlightened or free or left to our own devices, quote unquote, sort of way. But that's all just a result of our programming. It's
mm-hmm.
We're suffering the symptoms of having been artificially programmed. And the worst of it is that we don't know it.
Yes, that is precisely it. And if we make an attempt as an adult to know it, it seems difficult to us. It seems difficult to attack these, because that's the way it seems to be perceived by many people, is that you have to attack these things. You have to attack this abstraction of general grammar. You have to attack logic. Logic, especially as we get into it here, is seen as a very, very arcane thing to do.
Right.
But again, it's just a method that I might as well get into the various branches of logic right now. It's just a method that we have observed. It's a description. The method is the description of the observation. And in order to take contradictions out of our worldview or out of a more narrow view in something that we've encountered in life, these are methods to cope or to enhance life experience, the experience of going through life. So we've got a body of data together in a very sequential fashion. We work down from that existence being things, actions, states of being, attributes, and relationships. And we're coming down into a more focused view, a day-to-day or hour-to-hour view, as you just said. And the observations have been made that we can take contradictions out of our own viewpoint, out of this body of knowledge. We find the things that don't fit, that don't follow. And that's one of the definitions of logic, is that everything follows from everything else. If there's something that doesn't belong, it's not in that body of knowledge. So how do we do this? We go by statement, and really logic couldn't be made into a method very effectively or communicated to others until we got to the stage of being able to write. And the first observation was, very simple observation, is the two things that the mind does when it encounters something, the conceptual mind, this mind that can model things, the first thing it does is it either takes the ideas encountered apart, or it takes the ideas that it has in mind with a new observation and puts it together or generalizes. That's all the mind does. It takes ideas apart and it puts ideas together. So in the terminology of logic, of formal logic, Aristotelian logic, which is sometimes called categorical logic, again, going back to Aristotle's categories, his 10 categories, when you take things apart, you have an idea in mind that a model already exists, and you've come upon a new observation, and you want to fit that observation into that model. So you have a general idea, and you place this new observation into what you think is that general idea, the genera of something. You come upon a new plant. You already have the idea of biology and botany, the structure of plants. So you start taking the structure apart and you deduce from a number of clues that that fits into a certain family of plant. That is a deductive thought process. You deduce from general knowledge that you already have. Or another way to look at this is using the analogy of a detective, Sherlock Holmes, for example. He's investigating a murder scene, and he notices in this London townhouse that the perpetrator may have brought the mud on his boot to the scene of the crime. And he notices the color of the mud, and it's a dark red. Well, he knows from having studied the surroundings of the city of London that this particular color of mud only comes from the northeastern section. So he deduces that that's where he came from, as opposed to the whitish gray mud from the southern part of the city, the more chalky part of the city. So this is deduction. He already has this knowledge of the coloration of the soil around the various areas of London, and he deduces that the perpetrator possibly came from that area. So this leads him on to other clues and other deductions. He has a general body of knowledge, the knowledge of forensics, which relates to the past. This is a section in rhetoric, by the way, which we'll cover when we get there. But he has already put knowledge, general knowledge, into his worldview and can deduce from particular situations, like the particular situation that he's now looking into. Now, the other way of going, which is putting things together or generalizing, is that you come upon a group of plants, let's say, that are unfamiliar to you. And you start looking at the structure, and maybe you'll find two or three plants on this plot of ground that you finally can discern as belonging to a particular genera and even species. But you find this other plant, and its structure has a general look, the general structure of a plant, but you cannot find that it belongs to any known species. So you continue to find the structure or examine the structure. You continue to gather data about it until you have exhausted the idea that it has been categorized. You have gone through all the literature. So now you generalize that it belongs into a particular general category, its genera, and that it is a new uncharted species. So this is generalization. Or that, say, if you're a scuba diver, you've come upon sea anemone that look very much like a plant when you encounter it on a reef, for example. But once you study the structure, you can discern that it belongs generally to the animal kingdom rather than the plant kingdom. So it's taking a number of specifics or a number of new observations altogether. I'm sticking with the life sciences here because I'm somewhat familiar with it. Like mycology, like mushrooms or mycelia networks. And they look like plants. They're not mobile, but the one thing that they can do is they can take in energy from other than the sun. They can take energy, radiant energy, and exist. And it turns out that they are a completely different family. They're not animal and they're not plant, because their respiration is that they ingest oxygen just as animals do, and they exhale carbon dioxide just as animals do. And yet they have none of the other features or very limited features of an animal. So this is generalizing, and we all see examples of this. We see A, B, and C, and we look for the similarities in it to make a general statement. One of the generalities that I've come to is this idea of religion, of tying ourselves back to other mythologies, and seeing the similarities rather than the differences, and seeing that the religion that has become part of civilization, which was started in Asia and moved westward, is really the same religion. There are differences, and there are differences which we have become convinced are worth fighting about, of waging war over, but they're really quite similar. And this idea of waging war, we are convinced in the modern day to wage war. It is not an inbred situation any longer.
No, and that's part of our programming. And of course, just like politics and religion, and you know what, I think that we can safely say that politics and religion are almost one and the same if we take a look at it philosophically that way and how it relates to our social climate. But I can have a conversation about that for hours. but that's a good example. That's a good, just like the life sciences, that's a good example to use to explain these branches of logic. So we talked about deduction and we talked about generalizing. Are there other branches of logic that we should be aware of?
Let me name the four branches. The deductive method of reasoning that we have, taking things apart, our mind taking ideas apart from knowledge that we already contain. The inductive method of thinking, which is generalizing or putting new particular things together as a category so that we can understand it, which is really logic. And then the third branch is term definition of words. And finally, the result of all these is the fourth branch, which are the fallacies, the formal and informal fallacies. And these are actually the result of using the two modes of thinking, deduction and induction, and definition. Now, definition is really the heart of logic. When you define something, when you put it in, I was already using the term genera, put it into a general category, and then finding what is different about the term, about the word, this gives you the definition of the term. This identifies that term. And now you can take that term and go to the real world, because that term usually relates to something in the real world, or it started there. And these are what Aristotle called categorical terms. They fit one of his 10 categories. They fit into what can be the subject, what we're speaking of, and what we say or what we predicate about that subject, what that subject is predicated upon. Bird, subject, flies, predicate. Bird, flies, complete thought. So now we make the tie in to grammar here. And this is just a refinement. And really, logic, when we get into the rules of logic, and the rules that have been devised are really about deductive logic, about taking a baseline of general knowledge and then differentiating specific instances of our observations into that baseline knowledge. And Aristotle came up with very complex rules as to how we can manipulate complete thoughts or sentences to come to a true statement. But we use generalization, induction, to find a genera for a term, put it into a general category. Philosophy, its general category is a way of thinking. And it's what makes it different from mythology or science. it doesn't make it tries to minimize making comparisons. It looks at the thing itself, and it's not necessarily demonstrated. Philosophy doesn't use instrumentality, for example, as science does. So it's a way of looking at the universe and man's relationship to the universe without by a self-contained individual. So once this self-contained, self-determined individual can use, once he can use grammar, logic, and rhetoric, then he can explore these various modes for himself. He can learn these modes on his own and come to conclusions or think for himself. So
Well, I can see
those are the
this.
four.
Yeah,
Those are the four.
I can see them relating to each other and relating to the spiral on the whole, beginning with, okay, the four branches of logic, beginning with deduction, and then generalizing, which is I inductive, and
Inductive.
then defining the terms, and then recognizing logical fallacies using reasoning and deduction and generalization.
Well, the logical fallacies are discoveries that have already been made and cataloged.
Right.
They have, so we can take them as shortcuts. But for example, when I was being introduced to logic, the focus was not on the logical fallacies, but was really on definition, because I was to define this new field to me, which was dental science. And so I had to define the terms in there and relate it, come to a relationship, just as I had come to a relationship with general grammar, with the nomenclature of general grammar. And it made it real to me. And I understood that it related to something real. Well, by the time I was an adolescent, I could see, we all know that medicine of various types affect us, affect our lives. So I knew that there was a reason at this point to understand this new grammar and come to that understanding by definition, by identifying what we were speaking about specifically. So definition, finding the general category, which is induction, and then finding the differentia, and this is the way you come to a definition. I mean, you can get more involved, but this is the way of coming to a definition of a term, which is the way that we communicate to ourselves and to others our conceptual, our model of the world, our conception. The conception that I have can be expressed to you through words if we come to a general definition. And this leads to Socrates, who was the teacher of Plato in ancient Greece, and his famous utterance was, before you start a conversation, to define your terms. In other words, if there are two or three of you discussing, and this is the famous example, who are the just men in Athens? Who are those who understand and live a life of justice? And he says, before you get into that, you have to be sure that you all have identified the term justice, because the connotation, the denotation is there, justice. You use the word and it's denoted as justice. But the connotation among two or three of you may be different. So before you discuss who are the just men, and you can see that this is where empty palaver starts, because now you're getting into a modern day political discussion. Without discussing who are the effective men, you're discussing various personality traits. And this is what Socrates was saying. Before you start a meaningful discussion, define your terms. Or before you write a contract, which is just a three-part agreement, usually particularly easy to follow when it's in writing, is to define the terms that are being used. And I've seen contracts that were written in the 16 and 1700s, and the major part of the contract was the appendix, which just defined the pertinent terms so that everybody understood. The ones that I saw that were written in the 1600s, the glossary, which defined the terms, was in the foreword, and then the contract itself was placed behind the foreword. And then as we came forward in time, the body of the contract was on top, and this was in the afterword. And now we don't have any glossary at all. We go to attorneys so that they can do with your ideas what they will.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm going to interrupt you because it's important here to kind of, you know, rest on this a second, even though we're digressing a little bit, because let's look at what's happened in society. Is we've started out where the term definition was in the beginning, before the conversation, before we got into it. And then we got to a point, I remember when I was younger in school, even I'm thinking about the glossaries being in the back. Uh-huh. So we're not defining the terms in the beginning, we're defining the terms in the end, and now we're not defining the terms at all. We're leaving it up to some other entity. So we're pretty much just submitting ourselves and voluntarily becoming intellectually submissive and letting other people define the terms. It's so far removed from us that we don't even want to understand. We don't even want to define the terms. We think it's somebody else's job. And this has led to a degradation in conversation, which I don't know if you've heard or not. You've probably heard the show that I did with Jared Sanchez called Intellectual Intercourse, where we actually talked for an entire show, an entire episode about the degradation of conversation in our society, which leads to a degradation, a breakdown in communication, which when you have this breakdown in communication, you have this breakdown in understanding, and you have this breakdown in knowledge, and you have a kind of a blockade and a barrier in our relationships and our understanding of each other. So it's all very important. And the reason why, even though it seems like I'm digressing or I'm allowing digression, I'm covering it because it's important that we make the fire off those synapses in the brain and start to make these mental connections in how our society is treating this branch of logic, which is defining terms, and how that is relating to our ability to communicate with each other, and how that has affected our understanding and our knowledge and our wisdom of our world on a whole. So even though we're discussing logic here and we're talking about logic, it's important that we really think about this and connect the dots, so to speak, so we can see how that all these dots are in fact connected, because this is a very natural spiral, a very natural way of learning. But before I go into that too much, because I feel like I can philosophize about that for a while, before I go into that too much, let's round it back. So we talked about the branches of logic being deduction, generalization, term definition, and then fallacies. And we can go into more detail on fallacies during another session. We also went over what the logic stage is about in relation to the grammar stage in a narrow sense and in a broad sense, how it affects, how it relates to our lives. And we talked about the stage of grammar moving into the stage of logic, and the age, the adolescent age, being between 11 and 21 and around the puberty stage of life, and why that's important on a physiological level to for mammals to go through logic at this stage because of their brain development. Now, the next question I have, now that we understand what logic is and why we're moving into this stage at that age, there are kind of two questions, one and of the same, and you can go ahead and answer them in the best way that you see fit, is objective. The we understand what the stage is and why we're doing it, introducing it at this age. But let's talk about the objective of this logic stage. We understand the objective of the grammar stage is to build relationships and discover. What is the objective of the logic stage? And specifically, what is the objective of the child during the stage? And what should be the parent's objective in this stage as they help guide the child?
Well, the objective of all of these is to have clarity of thought so that you as an individual see your environment and your actions in the world clearly, so that you have optimum action and thought about it, so that you don't have contradictions, so that when you see a conversation taking place or a term being used, it's not something that you want to run away from. It's not something to be avoided. And this is why you introduce this at the adolescent stage, because these people in that stage don't have preconceptions. So they learn how to learn. They learn how to put together a body of knowledge, how to bring understanding to it by eliminating the contradictions within it, how to try to communicate it to themselves or others. And at that stage, they may find that they really don't have a complete understanding of that body of knowledge. So they go back to the grammar stage, get more data. And it's not difficult for them. This is the point. It is a natural process for them to go back to grammar, gather more data, take the contradictions out of it, and continue, and maybe go to the next subject or whatever they intend to. But the thing is, it's not an effort for them. This is the living of life, because they have intent in their lives. They have been able to make meaningful goals in their lives rather than abdicate their mind to others. This is when it becomes difficult. Oh, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to understand what that term means. Once you've reached the adult stage without having the dialectic developed within you at the proper stage, which is the inception of puberty, that area between 11 or 12 and 20 is when you don't have a lot of life experience. You have a lot of models. You've been exposed to literature, you've been exposed to your family, you've been exposed to your church, to your political situation, your country, your values, but you really don't have the overriding experience to say, I want to get on with action. No, I still want to prepare until I can live a life of intent, with clarity of mind, without fear of ignorance. Because that is a real fear. And this is what you normally term as ego, fear of knowing ourselves. That's really what ego is, the fear of knowing our own being.
It creates a separation. We talked about self-awareness in the beginning, and there's that separation between our existence and our self-awareness, which creates a wedge in our understanding of our existence.
Well, understanding is the point where we all get waylaid, essentially. As I say, it is that transition between childhood and pubescent adolescence where we are given a lot of contradictions. And this is what causes cognitive dissonance, where you're holding contradictions, where you're holding the two aspects of a spectrum in your head. Being a rationalist or being an empiricist, make your choice. Are you with us or are you against us? Make your choice. Now, there's a spectrum in there. And this is what judgment, this is where bringing definition to terms develops judgment. Because now you're working with a spectrum between the general and the specific. And it's this, as I say, logic is less structured than grammar. It's really a series of pointers. Try this, try that. You know, it really is a kind of a trial and error thing. But once you've done something three times, it generally becomes automatized in your brain. If it's something new, you've tried to bring definition to a term. After you've done it three times, it starts to become easier. Just like practice in anything. And the trivium for people, I'm just going to call them people, I'm not going to call them children or adolescents, but when people get it at the proper stage of life, the stage of preparation, they can live their stage of activity and their stage of giving back, which is maturity. They can actually, people who are given the foundations of preparation for life and then live the active life with intent, with satisfaction, without fear, can grow up to become mature individuals that can get then give back to the group of people who are now preparing for life. And that's the way it should be. And it's something that's been expressed and explained over and over again. And you've experienced it yourself. You've expressed it yourself, that you are finding that you're learning from your children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it should be. We gather everything from every generation before us, and we have the advantage of being the next, the last generation. So if we know how to get the pertinent knowledge and understanding from those that have come before us, we can add to it. And that's what bringing mankind forward is all about. That generation that's now either preparing, acting, or relating wisdom over and over again. That is the sequence. That's the sequence of life, as well as the sequence of learning and the sequence of knowing.
It's the perpetual motion that drives us. Whether we know it or not, it's the perpetual motion that drives us in a very innate way, in a very instinctual way. But I think when we're aware of it or self-aware, that adds benefit to our lives and it adds clarity to even the most mundane situations so that we can kind of sharpen our intellect, yes, but by sharpening our intellect and sharpening our self-awareness and being more connected to who we are and who we each other, we're able to really extract more benefit and more joy out of our lives that way, because we are in a sense, or actually not in a sense, we are essentially liberated and free when we're able to have that connection with ourselves. And that's why it's important to recognize this perpetual spiral and make a conscious effort to be connected to it, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes perfect sense, as I just said. This threefold pattern just keeps repeating at every level. I mentioned to you that I had not come upon the term trivium, which is now in the last short period of time has taken on this aura to it among some people that it's dogma. And that it's dogma to be memorized or something along those lines. But I didn't come upon the term until I was age 33. And I read Dorothy Sayers' essay called The Lost Tools of Learning. And she's the first person that I've ever seen. And I see a lot of people who have been exposed to the trivium in their lives, possibly at even the proper time. And they see her looking at the various stages of the preparation for life of childhood and adolescence as being that she makes the assumption that we all develop this way. And she had a sense that she was making an assumption. But there is, as I mentioned, a physiological reason, and it's the development of our brain, of our neural system, as to why we do what we do at the stages that we do. And she says that the childhood is for training. This is for didactic. Give children the facts. Let them take in the facts. Let them ask the questions. Don't necessarily try to test them. And this is where short tests in school, in public and government schools, are eroding what would naturally be your own self-esteem, the ability to count on yourself, to be self-sufficient. And when you come up with the wrong answers, this little by little erodes your confidence.
Well, what testing essentially does, and the way I'm seeing it now, is it forces a child as early as the grammar stage, very early in their lives, they're in the grammar stage, they're in that stage of discovery. And, I don't want to be afraid of using the word training here. I've also, just on a side note, I've often referred to the school system in a negative way, and I've used the word training in a ne negative way. But what's actually happening there is a reprogramming into an artificial reality. If we take the word training for what it is, like when you train a muscle, when you go to the gym and work out and you're training your muscles, or you're training yourself in some kind of athletic ability. A football player trains himself in how to play better football. This can be a very positive word because what we're actually doing is training our brain in how to process information, how to discover information, how to think, how to reason, and so on. But I just want to mention that really quick, so we're not afraid necessarily of the word training. And yes, this does happen at certain stages in our childhood because of the way our brain develops very naturally. So it's important that we adhere to that. It's important that we accept that and recognize that there is a physiological development happening here. But back to testing, when you're testing in school, you have a child that's at the developmental stage of grammar and discovery and, getting into that knowing of their world, and you're kind of forcing them into the rhetoric stage. By testing them and forcing them to regurgitate the information that they're discovering, and you're surpassing the understanding stage. You're not asking them to understand it. So basically, you have this child, they're discovering, and then you're saying, okay, now rhetoric. Now enter into the rhetoric stage. Completely surpass the understanding stage. Forget about the logic. You're in your discovery stage, and now we're going to put rhetoric on you. And it's really when you think of it that way and you realize it that way, it's almost mean and damaging and harmful
Well,
to force a child into that situation.
that's exactly what it is. You mentioned training. This is the time for training. Prepubescence is the time for training. Just give them the didactic info. The problem with training is that is what has now become the mode in secondary education. You don't go into education itself. You don't go into drawing the underlying meaning or drawing an interpretation out. You're continually, once you get into middle and high school, you're still being trained. And you don't even question it because your self-esteem, your self-confidence is now less than it would normally be. You don't trust yourself because you've been trained not to trust yourself. So they keep training you. They keep giving you the same old look for an authority to give you your mental content. So we have to keep all these things in mind. And this is, again, what you mentioned rhetoric. Remember, rhetoric contains both logic and grammar within it. So grammar is the point to start. And then logic is connected to grammar in that logic contains grammar. It contains the body of knowledge, and it's taking the contradictions out to make it even a more whole, cognizant piece. And then when you get up to rhetoric contains both of those. So it is a progression.
Right,
And it
which
is
is
a
why if you just introduce testing
right.
at an early age, it's like a grotesque twisting of the natural progression of learning.
Well, you mentioned the art of conversation. The discussion that you had with Jarrett. And you can have a discussion with a child, but it's not a test. You can ask him what he thinks, but there's not a consequence attached to it. There's not a grade attached to it, which is this, are you an A, B, C, or a D, F student, you know? You can have a con what is your opinion of that? And you don't necessarily have to correct him or just see what he says. Where is his imagination going? And this is the art of conversation, as opposed to the art of testing, which is designed to start shutting down your self-esteem. And then you reach that pubescent stage, your esteem is down. You don't even understand that a conversation is trying to get going in your mind, that the left side of your brain is conversing with the right and the right is conversing with the left, so that you can start to take this body of knowledge and take the contradictions out through this question and answer procedure. And that's really what the art of conversation among people is to come to a like conclusion, and optimally to come to the truth. That's what
You
conversation
know,
is all about.
as you're talking about this, I'm remembering, and it's coming to my mind that the Socratic method of learning and of helping others learn usually consists of roundtable discussions and conversations rather than what we've come to know as the conventional school setting, which is a teacher at the front of the room, and then the desks, which is, there are psychological connotations to that, the teacher being at the front and the big desk and above you and, so on and so forth. And I think those are obvious when we look at them. But the Socratic method usually consists of more even roundtable discussions and conversations rather than having this authority figure talking at you. What physiological benefit does this have to both the learner and the tutor or the parent? And why is this method especially useful in the logic stage?
Well, again, you have to be in the dialectic stage of life. If you get children together, it's really not necessarily to come to a conclusion. They're getting together to socialize, to use manipulatives, to gather data amongst themselves, but they're not trying to come to a conclusion. Whereas, when you go to seminar, it's called, you are trying to either as a group or to bring enlightenment to the individuals within the group to come to a conclusion, to come to the truth.
Well,
Now,
what
there's the
I just want to ask you real quick when you're talking about I want to make the distinction there. When you're talking about bringing children together, they're not the goal is not to come to a conclusion.
right.
Is that referring to the grammar stage?
Yes.
The goal is not to come to a conclusion, but then in the stage after that, which is what we're talking about now, the logic stage, the goal would be to eventually come to a conclusion.
That is the goal. Now, children may come to conclusions, but it's not elicited from them. When you're going to seminar, the idea is to elicit a conclusion
And
or
that's
to.
here in the logic stage.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, there's another method, I guess you would call it, of education that was put forth by Mortimer Adler, who devised the was influential in putting the Britannica Great Books together, and it's called the Padilla proposal. And he specifies this idea of gathering data, bringing an understanding to it, and then going into seminar. The problem that he has with that idea is that he's bringing the seminar to prepubescence. And I think that's a mistake just because of the neurological development. The seminar or coming together is a round table to discuss the Socratic discussion is after you have entered puberty. And of course, for the rest of life, when you get among people who can do this. So training, again, is all that should be done before adolescence. Just, and you can train them in various really advanced, what we would consider, again, adults would consider advanced, like learning a language or playing a musical instrument. But you can get children to read music, but you don't necessarily ask them to compose a piece. Now they may compose a piece on their own, as Mozart is said to have done, but it's not elicited. It's not something that will destroy their confidence within themselves, because whenever you enter a test, and that's the idea, is you either pass or you fail the test. You don't want to bring this idea of failure to a child. He'll learn that soon enough, you know, when he reaches puberty. But then
Well,
he'll
I'm
also learn
back
that
the
he
lot.
has.
Well, you know, that's to sake of time. I'm sorry. The
No, that's all right.
stage of puberty and that stage of logic, where we are eliciting deduction and reasoning. What is the benefit of doing it in this conversational roundtable discussion manner?
Well, it's the purpose, the end purpose of logic is some people have come to an idea, have come to a mature idea before others, and it is their practice in rhetoric that brings it forth. Whereas another person within the discussion may have a more mature idea within that body of knowledge. Usually you're having a discussion within a body of knowledge, and everyone in there has, as I say, a more complete or a more mature understanding of an aspect of that body of knowledge. They've taken out the contradictions. They personally have taken out a contradiction within that body that someone else has not yet. And yet that other person within the conversation, and that's the reason for conversation. That is one of the reasons for the art of conversation. That other person may have another aspect in which he has taken out the contradictions and is now able to pass that on. So by the time the seminar is concluded, everyone should have a more mature or a more complete understanding of that body of knowledge, including there's a school, there is a college which uses the seminar. It's called St. John's College. They have a campus in Annapolis, Maryland, and Santa Fe, New Mexico, and they all follow this the use of the Britannica Great Books as their curriculum. They give a 4-year liberal arts bachelor's degree there, and this is their method of teaching. And they call the professor the tutor. And there's an internet presence. YouTube has a number of videos, and they interview some of the tutors that are the instructors at this college, and they invariably say how much they learn. You know, they've been through all this before, and yet they're continually learning on these same bodies of knowledge that they continue to review through the years with the various students. So everyone who has come through the grammar and logic stage and is now practicing the rhetoric stage gains, which is again the idea that we come to an advancement of humanity as well as a personal advancement, that we go forward rather than making all these stops along the way like we're doing right now.
I just want to clarify when you say schools that use or institutions that I hate to even use the word institution or schools, but I
No, go ahead.
we know what we're talking about here. Any kind of environment, let's call it the environment that uses the seminar idea. A lot of times, because we've been so reprogrammed and preconditioned, a lot of us, when we hear the word seminar, the mental picture that comes to mind is a group of students sitting in desks and a teacher droning on and, you know, providing this long harangue. But that's not really what we're talking about when we say seminar. We actually are talking about the Socratic method of conversation and discussion. Am I correct?
Well, what you just described was a lecture.
Okay.
A
No, yeah,
seminar.
well, actually, yes, by definition it is a lecture, but just because of pop culture, well, not pop culture, but because of our culture and because of our programming, I think most of us, when we hear the word seminar, we're thinking lecture, and that's not necessarily the same thing.
Well, again, and I don't mean this to be derogatory, Lorette, but you're an adult, you see. So seminar seminar has this connotation to you
Well, yeah,
that
that's the point
yeah.
that I've been making. I'm an adult and I've been programmed. But here's the thing, here's what's special about me, and that's my ego talking, is that I'm able to recognize that I may be thinking incorrectly.
Absolutely, I give you that. But if you're a superhuman, you see, if you're a child or an adolescent, seminar is not something that you stand back from, or that you have a prejudice against or a preconception of. You haven't experienced it yet. You don't have a preconceived idea as to what it is. So
A seminar is it involves conversation and
it involves the art
but
of conversation, exactly.
Well, I wanted to clarify that because I wanted to kind of reiterate and summarize why this is especially useful as you've been talking about. And I'm just summarizing this for the purposes of the audience, and then we'll move forward a little bit. Why this particular way of this kind of seminar method or using this seminar Socratic method of teaching and conversation is especially useful during the logic stage is because we're using the branches of logic in our conversation. We're using deduction as we're talking to each other. We're defining our terms, we're generalizing, and we're recognizing fallacies. And this is all happening in conversation. And it can really only happen in conversation and in this roundtable discussion kind of manner. These using, utilizing, or practicing these branches of logic and methods of reasoning cannot really happen in a situation where you're just sitting and being talked at. There's a difference between engaging in a conversation and exercising our conversational muscle and using these methods of reasoning. There's a difference between engaging in that and being in a situation where you're actually not engaging at all. You're just kind of sitting there and letting some authority figure talk at you, and then, you're trying to just memorize that information. There's a very big difference there because you're not exercising your muscle in the latter situation. You're only exercising your muscle in the former situation, and you're using the branches of logic. And you're really getting that exercise there, and that's why this Socratic method is so especially useful during this stage. And they don't do this in school. This is not something that you see happening in school. In school, the basic setting, and well, school as we know it anyway, the basic setting is for children in this adolescent stage that should be in the logic stage. They're usually in middle school or junior high school, as it's called, and that's grade
Yes.
5 through about 9 or maybe 5 through 12 even. They're in that logic stage, and instead of engaging in discussion, they're in a situation where, first of all, it's compartmentalized, and there's a bell in between subjects, and there's a bell in between classrooms. So they don't get to make that connection that all subjects relate to each other because everything's considered separate, and they even have separate teachers for separate subjects. And they're in a physical situation where they're sitting and they're told to be quiet, and they're being talked at. And when they are asked questions and they are asked their opinions, it's often where there's a consequence if they don't answer it. And I'm not even going to use the word correctly, but if they don't answer it in a way that that specific teacher finds favorable, or a way that the administration finds favorable, then there's a consequence to that. So it's very destructive to the logic stage. It's almost as if school is purposely ruining our ability to use natural human logic.
That is the goal. The goal is not education, it's domestication to an authority that's been established for the last 6,000 years, and has shown itself in religion and government, and now even in the various modes of what I would call modern science. But I do want to make a distinction here. Is you can A person can attend a lecture. You mustn't forget the internal dialogue, because it's the internal dialogue between the two halves of the brain that are awakened at puberty or not. But if it is awakened at puberty, you can sit at a lecture and have, you are using logic to discern the value of what's being said by the person at the front of the room. And the classroom is set up like a courtroom or like a temple. So the priest at the front of the room or the judge at the front of the room who is expounding, you still, if you have this ability to gather data and efficiently take the contradictions out, have this conversation. Is this person speaking of a whole, or are there contradictions in his talk? Now, you are not in a conversational lecture, so you take away from that what is valuable to your context or to your worldview, and that which you find contradictory, you leave. So even though you don't agree with a person, you almost always, even if they're being deceptive, deceptions work because there is always a kernel of truth within a deception. And the deception is what sucks you in. So even when you're being given fallacious information, say in school, and I saw this quite a bit when I was in secondary school, after I had started to get, at the age of around 15, 16, 17, I started to notice that there were many things that I disagreed with or I found contradictory or were irrelevant to the subject at hand. And then, of course, every day after school, I went to my mentor. And within a 2 or 3 minute conversation, usually we would get whatever I considered a contradiction cleared up. And oftentimes it was my own understanding. And that's why I'm saying that you have to check your own understanding. And that's where the logical fallacies or the result of the first three branches come into being, because they are a shortcut. And again, if you just get a few of them in mind, you can go to a seminar or a lecture is what I'm getting at. But of course you do use this in the conversational or the seminar setting also. But there are some things that are just very general that are, when they're presented in a certain way, that doesn't mean that they are fallacious, but it sets off a light in your head. This needs checking. If the authority giving the lecture says it, that doesn't necessarily make it so. And that is the most common of the what are called the common logical fallacies, informal fallacies. And they're informal because and here's part of this question of using terms in various ways. They're informal because it can be used in either the form of deductive reasoning or the form of inductive reasoning. So either one of these, like an authority figure, is not, when an authority says something, it's no guarantee of consistency or truth. So oftentimes, if it's important to you, do your own research. You now have the self-esteem to question. And you don't have to question him if it's in a lecture situation. If it's in a discussion, then you question the person at hand. And if it's in a lecture situation, you go to someone that you trust, like my mentor, or he would lead me to a place where I could quickly bring a coherence to what was being spoken of in school. So I actually got to the point where I could have a conversation with my teachers through this idea. When I was a junior in high school, I started to be able to go up after class and make these very pose these very succinct questions and get an answer as to that day's lecture. So I really started to have a real good relationship with the teachers, but it was a one-on-one relationship and it was very brief. And then the rest of your life, you'll start to find, once you start to develop the trivium pattern within yourself, that these are the people that you learn from, individuals. And every individual has something to give to you, has something to teach you. But there are also many disagreements in there there's always something to take away, because as I say, even if it's deceptive, there's a kernel of truth. And this plasticity of mind leads you to that kernel of truth, and also to the fallacy, whether it's one of the known fallacies or whenever you find a contradiction, it's fallacious. But there are a list of fallacies, and usually they fall into three categories: of relevance, like that appeal to authority, the argument from authority. Is that relevant? Is it relevant that the authority said it? Well, just because an authority said it doesn't make it true. So that goes to relevance. There are fallacies of presumption, like circular reasoning. You're using the point that you're trying to argue about to validate itself.
Right. Like this book is true because the book says it's true.
Yes, and we know what book you're speaking
of. I couldn't sneak that past, could I?
Well, it's not only that book. There are several others.
Yeah, that's funny that you saw various, that right away.
Various chapters of the same book.
Nice try, Lorette.
And then there are fallacies that are ambiguous, like equivocation, using the same term in different senses, like the term love or the term justice that I was just speaking of. A just man. Is he just because he wants to punish the perpetrator? Or is he just because he wants people to be decent to one another? You see, that's the connotation of the word justice.
Which is paints an interesting relationship to ethics.
Yeah, sure.
That's very interesting. Okay, Gene, we're running out of time a little bit, but here's what I want to do. I have a final question to round off this session, and I know that we originally intended for logic to be one session, but I'm wondering if we can do another session on logic, if you would be willing to, because what I would like to do in the second session on logic is ask some practical application questions to kind of give parents a couple of ideas and pointers on how to enter into this logic stage with their children at this age, and some things that they can do practically, like academically, materials that they could use, what they should be introducing as far as academics, maybe mathematics and literature and things of that nature. Very, very practical kind of things, because I think we have a firm understanding of the grammar stage. We have a firm understanding of the logic stage, what it is, what the objective is, and why it's important. But I think a lot of parents out there might still be asking, great, I understand it, but how can I apply this with my children? What should I be introducing as far as, you know, mathematically or in literature, or what are some things that I can do to sit down and have a conversation with them? So before I move forward and round this off, would you agree to do a second session on logic and practical application before we move on to rhetoric?
Yes, I would, because logic is really the cornerstone that has been left out of our upbringing and needs to be brought into a true understanding, more so even than grammar or than rhetoric. As I say, grammar has the greatest development in rules. We're now in logic, which is a set of pointers, you know, just leading you toward these ways of developing judgment, and it requires judgment in itself to be developed, to apply. And then rhetoric, we'll see, is even freer. This is what we're dealing with in logic and grammar is critical thought, how to be critical about things so that we can see contradictions within them. When we get into rhetoric, we introduce this idea of creative thought. And this is where we round, as you were using the term, we round out our being as humans. We are now critical, creative thinkers.
Very good. So we'll go ahead and do that, audience, if you are listening. Just keep bear in mind that there's going to be a second session on logic. So if you find yourself feeling the way I described, where, okay, I get it, I understand it, I'm excited about it, but exactly how do I move forward here? We're going to give you that information. So you're going to want to stay tuned and keep listening. And I'd like to reiterate here something that you just said also. We have this critical thinking and then we have rhetoric, which is creative thinking. I know that there are a lot of people out there that think, okay, but creative thinking, is as early as childhood, and we want to be creative because, society, this kind of modern culture, this new age kind of culture that we're living in right now is all about being creative and expressing ourselves creatively. But I want to make the point that if we don't go through this natural evolution of understanding and wisdom, where we start out with knowledge and then we go through understanding and then we go through wisdom, we cannot really become the creative beings that we so aspire to be. That true creativity cannot come in the first stage of life. Now, yes, we can have a child at 4 or 5 years old expressing creativity with their crayons and drawing pictures, and we can say, look, they're so creative. That's not what I'm talking about. Of course, that's perfectly acceptable. But if we want to see the kind of creative expression, like, for example, that we saw in the Renaissance, it's important to first have the knowledge of your world and then to truly have an understanding of your world before you can creatively express your understanding, which is based on your knowledge. If you don't have that knowledge and understanding, your creativity is going to be empty. So that's why this natural progression is so important, so that we can continually progress and move forward and spiral on, in our knowledge. And that spiral is actually a spiral that's moving forward, which is interesting in and of itself. But I wanted to reiterate that. I also want to reiterate, like we were talking about, the difference between a seminar and a lecture. It's important that we make that distinction, first of all, between a seminar environment and a lecture environment. And Jean, I'm glad that you brought up that it's okay to attend a lecture. Lectures are perfectly useful and they're acceptable and they could be very, very educational in some situations. But as you described that, the situation that you're in a lecture, it is important that you enter into a lecture with the ability to utilize deductive reasoning. And that means that it's important that we go through our logic stage first, before we put ourselves into educational situations that use that kind of lecture environment. And this is why the use of lecture in education is more useful later on in life after we've developed and sharpened our logic. So I just wanted to reiterate that for the audience. And my last question for you as we round this off before, we set up our second session is about autodidactic learning. Now, I've been known personally to advocate for helping children become autodidactic learners because the idea is to learn how to learn, as in learning to teach ourselves. Now, you've mentioned before in one of our previous sessions a didactic pedagogy in learning, which is not autodidactic. But I know that we're on the same page. So can you just clarify what this means, a didactic pedagogy and learning, and why it's especially significant to the logic stage?
Well, didactic is training. It is synonymous for the word training. Where, by the way, a lecture can also be used in front of prepubescent children, and they'll get something out of it. You're providing the facts. It's not that it's used later in life or it's used to be analyzed later in life. You can get a person to come up front as an instructor and provide the didactic training, which is giving you the facts. Or when you read a book, what you're doing is taking, you're absorbing the data. So this is what didacticism is. Now, the dialectic, I use the term, it's just that there is no such term as autodialectic, because these are the two stages, the didactic and the dialectic, the question and answer of yourself or of others in a seminar or in a conversation. So when you're a child, you should essentially be more or less just given the didactic. This term autodidactic simply refers to what how you start to learn for yourself. You start with grammar, the didactic stage of just having the work presented to you. Then you bring logic to it later. Then you bring the dialectic into it later as an adolescent or after the lecture if you're an adult and you have this process going. So unfortunately, and maybe I'll leave this to you, Laurette, there is such a thing as coining a term. And when we're finished with our series here, hopefully you'll be able to have a true grasp of this didactic and dialectic process and the way it's used together. And you can coin the term auto-dialectic. And this is really the point we should be at as adults, that we have not only taken in the data, but we have eliminated the contradictions within the data itself or within our own mind to come to an understanding. So I think that they should be used together, the autodialectic, autodidactic self-learning process.
Well, what I'm understanding so far is that as we progress through our lives, starting from childhood, we need to go through this didactic phase mm-hmm. where we're being given information so that we can discover and we can acquire knowledge and then acquire the understanding of that knowledge. And then we come to wisdom, which is what are we going to do with this knowledge and how are we going to communicate this knowledge? And again, this is a spiral effect. But when we get to the older stages of our lives and we pass the puberty stage and we come into the wisdom stage, that's when the goal actually is to be an autodidactic learner where we have learned how to learn, but it has to begin with the didactic process of knowledge and understanding. Now, as far as dialectic and coining the term autodialectic, I'm not going to jump ahead of myself.
That's why I say when you come to an understanding.
Yes. I will go ahead and exercise patience and wait until we go through more of our sessions. And just on a side note, I am very excited about dedicating blocks of time in the next, I'm gonna guesstimate about a year and a half of my life to thoroughly understanding this and reading information and going through different series from different tutors, including you, Gene, which I'm very grateful for, to the eventual goal of not only coining a term, but creating a program that can really update and introduce the modern world to the trivium from a non-sectarian point of view or a secular point of view, and in a more modern kind of method or a more modern way, including my own personal flair.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. I know that it's going to take a while, and I'm fully dedicated to it, which is why I've dialed back on the frequency of episodes that I'm going to produce. But the eventual goal is to coin those terms.
Good.
So thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for joining us today. And thank you for agreeing to come back. At some point, I'd also maybe after we're all done with logic and rhetoric, I'd like to come back. We're also going to talk about the quadrivium and liberal arts, but I'd like to come back at some point and do an entire session on fallacies because I think that's important too. But that's far in the future and we can talk about that later. For now, thank you for giving us a firm understanding of what the grammar stages, what the logic stages, what the objectives are, and thank you for agreeing to join us again to go over some practical application advice for the logic stage.
I'm looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it too, Gene. This has been tremendous, and I'm getting a lot of positive feedback, so thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, Gene. I'll talk to you again soon, and we'll see you for Logic Part 2.
Very good.
All right, folks, that was logic, the logic stage in the trivium. That was part one of what will be two parts, so make sure you stay tuned for part two of logic. We're going to talk about some practical ways of applying the principles of logic in our families, with our children, and more importantly, with us, because if we understand it, then it just becomes a natural part of how we live, and there's nothing much extra to do that will seem daunting or inhibiting with our family. So it's important that we understand it first, and the rest really will just come naturally. It's a natural result of how we already are. So make sure you stay tuned for part two of logic. And then after that, remember, we're going to be going into rhetoric and then the quadrivium. This is going to be a phenomenal series that really may seem thorough, but it doesn't really give you the whole thorough spectrum. This whole thing is really an introduction to the trivium and quadrivium, but it's a thorough introduction, if you will. So I hope that you're enjoying it. I know that I'm getting a lot out of it. I'm learning a lot from it, and I hope that you are too. We welcome your comments and questions at unpluggedmom.com. Of course, if you have anything to discuss, let us know. And make sure you stay tuned to listen to the rest of the episodes that we have out that aren't necessarily on the Trivium. We have a lot of exciting interviews coming out and live shows and just a whole wealth of exciting episodes and entertaining and educational information for you to enjoy. So make sure you check that out, unpluggedmom.com. This is Laurette Lynn, your host of Unplugged Mom Radio, saying bye-bye.